K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to the show. This is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag, and in the decades that I've been doing this, I've been trying to bring our local community and anyone who happens to be tuning in, whether on the internet or around the world, some of the global issues that affect all of us in our daily lives, both locally or wherever we may be, and talk to some of the people who are very knowledgeable about what's going on in the world and also making a difference, trying to make a difference in how we deal with those issues. That certainly applies to my guest today. My guest is Jennifer Lowenstein, who's an American activist. She's very politically active. She's a member of the USA board of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, founder of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project, and she's helped organize demonstrations in Madison, Wisconsin. Just done a lot of work in bringing awareness to the situation in Israel, with Israel and Palestine, and also just what is going on there right now and has been for decades. So welcome to the show, Jennifer. Thanks so much for making the time to be here.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
We appreciate you doing that. Obviously, there's something being written about. You sent me several articles today, and I had seen some of them. There's something being written about what's going on in Gaza and Israel every day. Just a lot of things happening. Tomorrow is the first deadline, March 1st, for phase one of these ceasefire agreements. And there's a lot of questions about what will happen around that. And there's also all the actions that have happened, of course, all the domestic ones that may not be related by the Trump administration, but also the international arrangement that he's made. So there is, as I said, there's a lot going on and a lot to talk about. But I really want to start out with your background, because you grew up in Israel and have personally spent a lot of time in Gaza, in the occupied territories. Maybe you can inform the audience a little bit about your background and what you've experienced. I know that's hard to summarize a lifetime of many years of doing this, but just your experiences.
Well, I want to correct you. I didn't grow up in Israel, but I did live there when I was 2 and 3 years old. My whole family moved over there then, and I have some memories of it, but, you know, you're too young at that age. I went back as a junior in college for my semester abroad to study at Hebrew University, and I think that I was always very interested in Israel growing up, in part because my parents were very active in civil rights, and they were part of the anti-Vietnam War movement. So I grew up with a family that was very socially conscious, and one that was, you know, pretty much all of the members of my family have always been activists for social justice. I should add, by the way, going back to the fact that I lived there when I was a child, my parents left after a couple of years because they hated it there. And it wasn't for any political reason at all. It was because in 1963 and 64, when I was there, Israel was still very much a third world nation. And they were Americans who were used to a much different standard of living. So, you know, it's kind of ironic, because when it really came down to it, they just wanted to be more comfortable. Of course, Israel is a very different country today. And it was when I went there as a junior in college, it was even more different then. And each time I went back, I could see changes in it. I will say, though, that when I was a junior, and that was back in 1981, it took me, and I want to be honest about this, it took me probably less than 2 days, two full days of being there to figure out that there was something very wrong with the society, that it was very segregated. Today we're saying it's an apartheid society. I don't know if it would have been classified as one in 1981 or not. I suspect in some ways, yes, because Arabs and Israelis, Palestinians and Israelis and Jewish Israelis, even when you were talking about what's called Israel proper, Israel not including the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, it was a society that separated itself from the Palestinian Arab culture that was indigenous to the region. And I saw that, and it was very visible. The difference, though, is that at the time, Israel still had pretenses towards being a very liberal nation. I mean, we can discuss ad nauseum whether it was or not. I do believe as a settler colonial society, it was all always to the right. But within the country itself, within the daily day-to-day politics, the Labor Party was the dominant party for, you know, most of Israel's existence up until then. Only in 1979 did the Likud party come into power. But since then, and if I go back and look at all of my different, all of the different times I spent there, it has shifted very notably to the right. And today, you'll find within Israel a very right-wing society with a very small left, a very small peace group within it. And, you know, you'd see polls during last year where at least 3/4 of the country supported the war, if not more. Some people were saying as high as 90%. I completely believe that because Israel had moved so far to the right. And what I think happened over the last, I would say, 8 decades or since Israel was founded, is that it came into its own as a settler colonial society. It started out with all kinds of promises about equality and democracy, but really to have a Jewish state and a democratic state is a contradiction in terms. And over the years, that became more and more evident, not only within Israel proper, and I really hate that term, but definitely insofar as Israel treated its Palestinian neighbors in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And of course, they're now part of Israel. People always talk about the occupied Palestinian territories, and there's a lot of discussion about left one state and two state solutions. And the fact is, Israel is one state today. It is one state in which you have 7 million Palestinians living as second-class citizens or less. I would say less. Their lives are miserable, and they are treated miserably by the state. That's evident in all walks of life, whether housing or farming or academia, it's there. And I think what we saw last year, we're seeing the culmination of this settler colonial state. We saw it in Gaza. We're starting to see it in the West Bank. And that is a policy that is, if not blatantly genocidal, and much of it is blatantly genocidal, it is certainly a society that has marginalized the Palestinian community to the point that it actively seeks to expel, dispossess, and kill its Palestinian population. And I think people who want to deny that reality need to wake up because it's very obvious.
It's interesting that you say that 90% of the Israelis today are in support of the government policies. As I've seen, I've felt from afar as a Jewish person myself that sometimes that there was more dissent about the policies within Israel than within the Jewish community in the United States. Maybe that's inaccurate, but I am interested in the time, because when you did go back, and I'm not sure how many times you've been to Gaza and to the other territory several times. I don't know how many times or how recently, but you made the choice to experience that directly, going into the and being even in the refugee camps. And did you feel like, as a Jewish person in Israel, not a native Israeli, but that you were kind of on the other side of that? And what kind of experiences did you have when you were in the refugee camps, or in, you say they're not really occupied territories, but it's like everyone, every Palestinian in Israel is sort of living in the same kind of repression.
Well, a couple of things. I just want to not correct so much, but be more specific. When I say that 90% of the population supported the war on Gaza, I don't mean to suggest that 90% of the population supports Netanyahu. I mean, there's obviously a lot of dissent from his policies, but there we begin to look at how long the war should have gone on, whether it was correct, if that's the right word, to continue the war, or whether there should have been more negotiations, whether diplomacy would have gotten the hostages home more quickly than bombing the hell out of Gaza. So, there's a lot of dissent within Israel, and I don't want to disregard that. But in terms of Israel being a very patriotic state that I think very uniformly views Hamas and many of the militant groups in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank as the enemy, I think, yeah, there's a fairly unified front in that regard. And also, when I didn't say there weren't any occupied territories. I just want to clarify that. Of course, there are. The West Bank is occupied illegally. The Gaza Strip is occupied illegally. East Jerusalem is occupied illegally. Certainly the Golan Heights are too, even though they're not Palestinian. And of course, now South Lebanon and a good chunk of Syria, they're also occupied illegally. And I don't want anyone to think I don't see that. It's very obvious. What I'm saying is that I tend to look at Israel as one unit. I mean, these territories have been occupied for so long, and they are completely controlled by Israel. Even Area A, that is supposed to be Palestinian controlled, it's only Palestinian controlled on a sort of micro level. On a macro level, it's Israel that decides what goes into the cities, what comes out, who can leave, who cannot leave. I mean, it's, you know, the control over your daily life that the Israeli government has, if you're Palestinian, is enormous. And that shouldn't be disregarded. Now, when I went to the Gaza Strip, I lived there in 2002. I went back probably 10 times. The last time I was in Palestine was in the summer of 2022. I didn't go to the Gaza Strip then because I was banned from the Gaza Strip in, I think, 2011. I'm trying to remember, 2010, 11, something like that. But I did go to the West Bank. And contrary to what many people might think, I used to feel a sigh of relief as soon as I got out of Israel and into Gaza. Soon as I got into the West Bank and out of Israel proper, I'm using that term again. And the reason is because I didn't belong in Israel. I could feel it. I didn't want to be part of a society that could live like first world Europeans and Americans, knowing that people were living in some of the most dismal and wretched conditions less than an hour away from them in Gaza and in the West Bank. And I think people need to be made aware of that. Gaza, before it was completely destroyed, it was a very poor area with a terrible infrastructure. It didn't have enough money to repair, and that's because of Israel. The food that was allowed in by Israel was not sufficient to keep people fed nutritiously, and that was also deliberate, and so on. But what I want to say is that, you know, when I got into Gaza, for example, and I said I felt a sigh of relief, it's because I felt there I was protected. And to clarify what I mean there is that people treated me like royalty. And, you know, of course, I didn't walk around with the Star of David around my neck announcing that I was Jewish. I wouldn't do that anywhere because it's, you know, it's not something you do when you travel overseas. But after I lived there for a while, all of the people I knew and worked with knew that I was Jewish. And contrary to what people might think, I was treated better because of it. And that's because people understood that I was having a difficult time accepting Israel and its apartheid system, and that I came to Gaza to be with the Gazans, the people of Gaza, the Palestinians of Gaza. But I came there to see what was the reality that was being hidden from us. And I think that's very important. I want to add that I did not live and work in the West Bank, although I traveled there many times, but I did live and work in the south suburbs of Beirut, Lebanon, for many times. So I lived in Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon in 2000, 2001, you know, up until, well, as I said, the last time I went back there was 2018. And I received similar experiences there. You know, after working in the camp hospital, I worked in a camp called Burj al Barajna in South Beirut. I taught English to doctors who needed to stay up with medical terminology and that kind of thing. And the same thing happened to me, both as an American, or I should say as an American, as a woman, and as a Jewish person. I found that once I got to know the people better and they got to know me, we were very much at ease. There was some suspicion from some people that, you know, maybe she's a spy, maybe she's here with the CIA. There's always a bit of that. And actually for good reason, because there have been many spies from Israel and the United States in Lebanon in the past, and also in the occupied territories, people who come in and pretend to be Arabs to get intelligence to surveil the area. That's very common. So I didn't find that surprising or upsetting. But the people who knew who I was and they knew my background, they treated me extremely well. And I would go back in a flash. In fact, I've tried to find work over there in order to stay for longer periods of time. And the same is true, and I'm a little bit digressing here, the same is true of many of the countries in the region. And the reason I'm saying this is because on Twitter the other day, I saw a comment by a person who said, as a woman and a Christian, the only place that I can go and feel safe in the Middle East is Israel. And I just read that, and I just thought, that is so pathetic. I traveled by myself through Syria in 2005, and I was welcomed and treated so well by strangers, by complete strangers, but, you know, in different parts of the country. And, you know, I think most people are going to be treated that way. If you go there because you're interested in the country, because you're fascinated by its history, because you're interested in its future, people want to show you around. They want to tell you about their land, their language, their culture, their traditions. They show you their art. I sat in the Umayyad Mosque for an hour just to take in the surroundings. And like I said, that's a bit of a digression. But I just think it's misinformation that Americans have and that American Jews have that somehow they're not safe if they go into the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. That's nonsense. Now, if you go in with a uniform on carrying a gun, that's a different story for obvious reasons. If you go in representing the United States government, no, you're not going to be very welcome, especially now when you've got our president, you know, actively calling for the displacement of 2 million people out of their land. So, you know, of course, you have to draw a line somewhere. People are not going to be particularly welcoming to people coming in and saying, well, we think you should all leave or whatever. But anyone else, I think, is going to be treated extremely well. In fact, I felt that people were warmer and more hospitable in the West Bank, in Beirut, and in the Gaza Strip than they were in Israel.
Well, I appreciate hearing about your experiences there. Thank you. And for that perspective, I think it is certainly different than what people see in the media here.
Absolutely. All we hear about are terrorists and ISIS and Islamic Jihad and Hamas, as if these groups aren't made up of a bunch of people just like us. I don't like their ideologies. ISIS, I have to say, is a world apart. ISIS is nothing like Hamas, nothing like Islamic Jihad, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, nothing like the Muslim, but totally different things, totally different, you know, everything. But, you know, I really see it as one of my jobs to humanize the people in the region because we have such false notions. Here's another example. When I lived in Lebanon, in the evenings, I would go to the downtown area and walk along the Corniche, which is a long, you know, it's a strip of land right next to the Mediterranean Sea. It's like a promenade, I think is the best word. Everyone comes out in the evenings, especially in the summer, to walk along the sea. There are people out selling food, corn on the cob, all kinds of things. Kids come out to play. It's just, that's a social, it's a whole social scene. I would walk along this corniche in the evenings, you know, it goes on for a couple of miles, and I would see women covered from head to toe, except for their eyes. I would see women in a traditional hijab, and I would see women in shorts and spaghetti straps shirts jogging. And, you know, there's this notion that doesn't happen. Well, it does happen. And, you know, you don't have to cover your hair if you live in Lebanon. You don't have to cover your hair if you live or you didn't have to if you were in Syria. I don't know what's going to happen with the new government. But there are incredible stereotypes about Middle Easterners that we really need to get rid of. Because, as I said, you saw everything from the most modern to the most traditional in Lebanon and Syria and definitely in Palestine as well.
I want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. My guest for this live show is Jennifer Lowenstein, who is an American activist. She spent a lot of time in Israel, in Gaza, West Bank, Lebanon, as we're hearing about, and that part of the world, and writes about that. And also one of the founders of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project. She's been very active in Madison, Wisconsin, which is a very interesting organization in itself. I've been to their website, and they publish a lot of links to articles about what's going on now. Maybe talk a little bit about that, because that brings it back, your activism and your support for the Palestinians to the U.S., where I know you've experienced a lot of pushback. In fact, was it in 2010 where there was an issue in Madison itself about support for the Palestinians?
Oh my gosh. Well, when the Madison Rafa Sister City Project took root, we had such pushback from the Madison Jewish Community Council, which is now part of the Jewish Federation. It's a nationwide group. I received death threats when I was part of this group. And I was at that time very much the face of it, because I was the one going back and forth to Rafa the most often. And, you know, yeah, the pushback was intense. People didn't want to hear that Palestinians were human beings. And I hate to put it that bluntly, but that was the truth. Here's an example. In 2002, and this is relevant for today, in 2002, during the Second Intifada, the Israeli government went forward with what they called Operation Defensive Shield, which was in part the temporary reoccupation of the West Bank. And in April of 2002, Operation Defensive Shield, in this operation, Israel went into the Jenin refugee camp, surrounded it, put it under siege, and demolished it. People who look at Gaza now and see a kind of destruction and ruin that is almost incomprehensible would be interested in knowing that Israel did that to the Jenin refugee camp in 2002. It's just that that was on a micro level. There you had 13,000 people displaced and all of the homes, everything in the area completely obliterated. But that was just, and I just say that ironically, just a refugee camp. Now Israel has done that to the entire Gaza Strip on a scale that is just unprecedented. But when I was in the Jenin refugee camp, I was there because I was living in Gaza at the time. I was working for a human rights organization in Gaza called the Mizan Center for Human Rights. Mizan is the Arabic word for the scales of justice. And typical of the times, if you were in Gaza, you were prevented by Israel from going to the West Bank, even if you had family there, even if you were accepted to one of the universities there, even if you needed medical health there. No, if you were in Gaza, you couldn't leave. So as a result of that, the Mizan Center sent me, because as an American, I could travel freely to the Jenin refugee camp the day that the Israelis pulled out of the camp. And so I was one of the first Western journalists into the camp and saw the destruction firsthand. I even have a photo exhibit from that time. And I saw among, as well as the ruins and, as I was saying, a scale of destruction that most people can't imagine. I mean, everything was destroyed. I remember walking into the camp from a neighboring village with a long line of other journalists who were also walking into the village. Into the camp, that is. And I got there and I just saw this big sort of empty landscape full of mud and dirt and wreckage. And I walked up to this older man and I asked him where the refugee camp was. And he waved his hand at me, beckoning towards the distance, and said, "There it is." And it was completely destroyed. As I was there, I ended up following a team of EMS people, emergency medical team, as they carried a dead body to the hospital, the camp hospital, which was down beyond most of the wreckage. And at the camp hospital, there were medical teams and workers in the back of the hospital outside digging up the bodies of people who were buried during the siege and who had not been allowed out. In other words, people who had died during the siege were not allowed to be taken and buried in the cemetery. So the people in the hospital, the doctors and nurses, etc., they had to bury those dead people so that disease wouldn't spread. So when I was there that day, those bodies were being dug up. They were in shrouds, and those being brought in from the camp who were newly deceased or recently deceased were being laid out in shrouds. So you had different rows of dead bodies of people, and then a number of people from the camps going to try to identify their loved ones. And I took pictures of all of this. I mean, this is, as I said, these are pictures I have in my exhibit. And the reason I'm talking about this is partly to talk about our prejudices. I remember when I got back, I gave a talk at the University of Wisconsin to a group of people about what had happened in Jenin. And it was in June at the time. And a number of, there was a program at Wisconsin at the time that brought in retirees from Florida. They came up for classes and a program of some sort at to Madison, Wisconsin. And they had seen my name, Lowenstein, on a flyer that was put up around campus for this talk, and probably just assumed I was going to be a cheerleader for Israel. So I got to this talk. I was speaking in front of a fairly large audience, and I started to put up these pictures of Palestinians, in one case, a man kneeling over the bodies of two people. Again, these bodies were in shrouds and their names had been written on the sheets in Arabic. And one person was just standing over them as if he was praying. And there was another picture of a woman who was like shaking her fists at all the journalists standing around photographing this. She was shouting to the crowd to stop taking pictures. And I remember at the time when I was in Jenin thinking, she's right. This is in many ways undignified. But I thought it was more important for the world to see what was happening at that point than to respect her wishes. So I did take pictures. But the point is, when I started putting those photographs up for the audience, the pushback was absolutely extreme. I mean, people in the audience were shouting at me. One woman shouted, she said, "Lowenstein, I would never have you for a daughter." And then one of my friends said, "Well, she would never have you as a mother." But then I put up a photograph of some of these shrouded bodies, and a woman in the back of the audience shouted, "That never happens." And I just remember that shout in her words and thinking, you know, what does she think? I invented this. This was 2002. Yeah, there was Photoshop to some extent, but, you know, just the hearing her say that didn't happen was eye-opening, because I think in this country, you don't hear about it. You hear about Israelis being blown up in suicide bombings, which frankly is terrible and shouldn't happen, and I would never condone them. But you don't hear when Palestinians are blown up or have their homes blown up over them. You don't hear about a handicapped man who couldn't get out of his home because he was in a wheelchair, and the Israeli chief who was in charge of the operation telling the soldiers to blow up the home over him. You don't hear about the little kids who get shot. You don't hear about this little kid named Majid who went out on his balcony because he wanted to play, and he was shot to death by an Israeli sniper. You just don't hear the other side of the story. And so when somebody yells that that's not happening, you know, when they see dead Palestinians, I thought it was just exceptionally telling. And the reason it's relevant today is because Israel is now back in the Jenin refugee camp. It's also back in Tul Karim and Nur Shams. These are three refugee camps in the northern West Bank. They've all been invaded, now occupied by the Israeli occupation forces. And 40,000 people have now been displaced. Now, remember, back in 2002, it was 13,000 that had been displaced from Jenin. Today, it's 40,000 plus people who have been displaced from these three camps. And the Israeli response right now is, no, you can't go back. You're not allowed to go back. So many people that I talk to are afraid, very much so, that the West Bank is about to be annexed straight out by the Israelis, courtesy of the United States, or at least a good chunk of it, and that many of these Palestinians are going to be forced into Jordan or God knows where. That's the fear. I don't know that that will happen, but we're certainly on the brink of it. These are definitely policies of ethnic cleansing, of mass destruction, of mass demolition, of, you know, land theft goes on every day. The Israeli army encroaches on a farmer's land, sending settlers in there to fight and destroy property. Olive trees are cut down. I mean, it's just really I think, unbelievable. I have never met an activist for Palestinian rights who didn't say that once they saw firsthand the way Palestinians are being forced to live and what happens to them on a day-to-day basis. I've never met anyone who hasn't said, it changed my life. I couldn't believe it. The other thing that they say routinely, and I said it myself, I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't come and seen it with my own eyes. That's what they say. And, you know, it's that blatant. And the last thing is that it's even worse than what I read about. And it is, when you see it up close and you see the kind of apartheid policies being carried out, it is shocking. It's appalling and it's shocking. And yet it is happening every single day.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support People Powered Radio at kmud.org.
Let me remind people, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Durschlag. My guest, Jennifer Lowenstein, is talking about the situation in Israel and Palestinian areas, the West Bank, Gaza, her experiences there. And it's really eye-opening to hear about it, but as you say, not nearly as an impact as seeing it firsthand as you have. And we can definitely hear that in the way you describe it. This is a call-in show. We did have one call-in. Have they called back yet, Dennis? I don't know. Not yet. They're holding? Okay. Well, let's take the caller. Do you have a question or a brief comment for Jennifer?
Oh, I sure did, and a question, too. And as a matter of fact, as she was talking about being there in 1963, it reminded me, you know, we've got RFK Jr. Well, his dad was Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy, I think, was running for president in 1968, and he went down into the U.S. South and saw the utter wreckage of, you know, Americans were living in utter poverty. And it blew his mind because he, you know, being in a rich family, had never realized that in the South there were such decrepit areas. And he became a champion. An analogy from the same era. And the problem then in America and the problem then in Israel was taxation without representation. That if Israel is supposed to be a democracy, then everybody should be able to use the drinking fountain. It wouldn't be, you know, separate bathrooms, this whole separate but equal kind of crap. That we, the people, own the country, and that bigots are making sure that some of us don't get to use our property. It's taxation without representation. But what I wanted to ask her, and she sounded like she was getting into it, about a year ago, the United Nations came out with a report, and this is the United Nations Commission on Trade and Development, and that oil had been discovered exactly underneath Gaza, and it's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil, and that offshore of Gaza is fracking, and that fracking is being run by Chevron. So, you know, today is a buy nothing Project 2025 day, boycott Chevron. But I'm just wondering if she's familiar with the oil and fracking under and offshore of Gaza, which makes it, you think Donald Trump could make money at a gambling casino in the Holy Land, what the oil companies would do with that.
Do you have a
comment? Yes, I am very familiar with that. However, it's not oil, it's natural gas. There are natural gas fields off of Gaza. There are also natural gas fields in the Mediterranean, off of northern Israel and Lebanon, which have been very much contested. I think the contest, so to speak, between Lebanon and Israel was mostly resolved last year. But yes, there is natural gas off of Gaza, and it does stand to be extremely profitable for whoever or whatever companies decide to tap into it and market it and sell it and all of that. The thing is, the thing with that I want to say, though, and you know, I want to be completely honest here. The Israelis are not the only ones profiting off natural gas reserves off of the Mediterranean. Some in the PA are as well, the Palestinian Authority. You know, anyone who can profit off it will. There are some very corrupt people within the PA who are all too happy to work with the Israelis to get what they can out of this natural gas. But I think the bigger question is the presence of this resource the reason why we destroyed, the U.S., because the U.S. backs Israel and Israel, is that the reason why Gaza was destroyed? And the answer is no. Sure, that's something that is very coveted. I'm sure lots of companies are looking for some lucrative deals. But the fact of the matter is the problem, quote unquote, of the Palestinians goes back even before the founding of the State of Israel. Even Theodor Herzl, who founded the Zionist movement, knew that there was a big problem in the fact that this was not a land without a people for a people without a land. It was a land that had a people in it with a culture and a history and traditions and a language and its own dialect. And those people had been there for thousands of years. And Herzl himself had to contend with this problem and thought, you know, maybe we have to put them somewhere else. That's back in the 1890s. And, you know, as time went by, this problem of the Palestinians has not gone away. If anything, it has gotten worse because the population has expanded so dramatically. And so what happened in the Gaza Strip was not a result of Israel, for example, wanting to control Gaza so it could get the resources. It's happening because Netanyahu and his especially right-wing ministers want to get rid of the Palestinians. And they're happy to do it by dispossessing them. They're happy to do it by displacing them. And frankly, they're happy to do it by killing them. And that's been the case for a long time. And it's extremely worrying, especially to people living there. I have many friends in Gaza, so I've been hearing stories firsthand that are literally hair-raising. And the fact of the matter is, Israel wants these people to disappear, and they're happy to help them disappear in any way possible.
And again, this is Global Stuff. Jennifer Lowenstein, my guest, spent a lot of time in Israel, an activist, American activist, about Israel-Palestine policies, a journalist. Her works appeared in journals such as the Journal of Palestine Studies and a regular contributor to the Counterpunch magazine. Not a lot of time left, and I think we have to talk about what the current status is there. And I can't but think that this, you know, in leading into that, that this is not something that Trump himself created, but there's this video that I'm sure you've seen of them, this vision of creating Gaza as this wonderful place where these two kids are jumping through a tunnel and come out into the Riviera of the that coast, and there's gold statues of Trump there. I have to think that that's a spoof. It's never been proven. Some people say that he created it himself, but that's the whole concept, that they're going to remove these 2 million people, which has had a huge pushback, not just from the people who live there and do not want to leave, but from the region in general. Now we're at the end of this, supposedly tomorrow, though it sounds like it's going to be extended, of this first phase one of the ceasefire, and going into phase two, with where all of the people that the Hamas are in Hamas custody are released, and also a lot of Palestinians that the Israelis have in custody. How are you seeing all these current developments?
We need another few hours for that. Yeah, I did see the video. For me, I thought it was an absolute obscenity. I wanted to name it Our Shared Values, because it was with Trump and Netanyahu sitting on a beach, sipping whatever, you know, and everyone I saw in the video, except for possibly a belly dancer, all nice white colonists in my mind. This is the culmination of the European white man's burden, you know, go and occupy a land, get rid of the natives who are there because, you know, they're half devil, half child, as the poem White Man's Burden of Rudyard Kipling said. You know, it is as perverse. It's disgusting. They're celebrating this rich materialist money playground for white people who want to, you know, sail their yachts in the Mediterranean on the backs of close to 100,000 dead and far more wounded, and a president who wants to displace 2 million people. Now, it's hard to even put into words how sick that video is. As far as the peace process, or I shouldn't have hardly that, the ceasefire process that is going on right now. You know, I read today an Israeli general or an Israeli spokesman from the Netanyahu government basically saying that the very idea of ending conflict in Gaza, of moving into phase two, is an impossibility. That's how Netanyahu and his right-wing government view it. And so what I'm thinking is, yeah, I think it's very possible that phase one will be extended. As I see it, Israel wants to get all of its hostages back before it goes back to war. And some of the reports I'm reading are that Israel wants to have its military destroy every standing structure in Gaza that's left and expel the population. God knows where. All of the countries in the region, of course, are pushing back against this. But it's kind of sad to hear that because, you know, the war lasted almost 17 months and the Arab states certainly didn't raise many objections, and neither did the European states certainly not the American government, which is still funding. There was something around $3 billion in military aid was guaranteed today to go over, was approved, I believe, by the Trump administration today. So we keep sending massive amounts of military equipment to Israel, bunker-busting bombs, which, you know, to digress a little bit, bunker-busting bombs are not only devastating in civilian areas, they're 2,000-pound bombs that can go through concrete bunker buster. Something like 80,000 tons of bombs were used to kill Hassan Nasrallah, the secretary general of Hezbollah in Lebanon. In other words, these bombs are very, very destructive. And one reason that Israel wants them is because you need bunker busting bombs to destroy the nuclear facilities of Iran. And that is something that's high on Israel's agenda. I don't know if it'll happen. It depends on how Trump views it and how much leeway he allows Netanyahu. But the idea that these weapons are going over there now and have been nonstop since long before the October 7th, and they're being used. Gaza is a laboratory. Anthony Lowenstein, who's not related to me, wrote a book on that called The Palestine Laboratory, about how Israel is basically testing out its weapons in civilian areas in the Gaza Strip. And, you know, not only we're talking about cluster bombs, we're talking about white phosphorus, which poisons the ground, poisons the atmosphere. We're talking about when the buildings collapse, the asbestos from in the buildings collecting in the dust around it. Gaza has been made a toxic place in every way imaginable. There's no safe drinking water. Food is getting in now since the ceasefire was signed, but it's not getting in to the level that is needed. and there isn't heavy equipment being brought in to clear away the rubble. That's on purpose. There are also no caravans or mobile homes getting in so that people can live someplace else besides tents. Only this week, 6 children died of hypothermia because they can't live in it. There's nothing left. Their homes are gone. So they're pitching tents outside of destroyed buildings in toxic heaps and dying of the cold. I mean, what kind of country does that to another people? And when I say that, I include us, the United States. Israel wouldn't have a war to fight if we weren't giving them the weapons to fight it with. This is the Americans doing this, not just the Israelis.
Let me jump in because we don't have a lot of time left, and we do have another caller.
Okay.
Hi, you're on the air. Do you have a question or comment for Jennifer?
Yeah, is this me?
Yes, it is.
I guess I'm just curious. I'm trying to understand what the Israeli action would look like from a context of actually seeking peace. You know, I guess because that's sort of where I don't know. I've ignored this conflict for the most part, and I'm not an expert in it at all. And it seems obvious to me that Israel acts from a place of absolute power supremacy with no need to compromise on anything. And that's a hard place to find a compromise from, obviously. But I wonder if the guest has any perspective on what genuine Israeli efforts at peace would look like or should look like or could look like.
All right. Thank you for that. Jennifer?
Yeah. I often say to people that Israel has tried absolutely everything in the last 80 years except making peace. And that's why peace hasn't been made. If peace were to be made, there are possible a two-state solution. See, the thing about this conflict is that although many people will say it's too complex, you can't understand it, it's actually not complex. It's a conflict about land. It's a conflict that should have been resolved in 1947, but wasn't. It's a conflict that Israel has stoked because each time, you know, in 67, it was occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Then later on, you have, East Jerusalem is now considered, it's pretty much annexed. And with every administration, rather than really making peace, what's happening is that the expansion of the greater Israel tendencies are what's come to the fore. In other words, the kind of complex infrastructure that Israel has built in the West Bank is not part of a peace plan. This is a way of entrenching Israel within the territory. You build roads, you build settlements. These roads are for Israelis only. I mean, imagine going someplace and realizing, okay, well, I'm no longer in the main part of Israel. I'm going into the West Bank. And my friends who are Palestinian can't drive on that road because they're not Jewish Israelis. You know, that's what's being entrenched. You've got a whole infrastructure, water, electricity, everything that's being entrenched in the West Bank. The settlers, you know, back in 81, I don't know if you had 80,000 settlers. Now you have close to 1 million. I mean, 750,000 settlers at least in the West Bank. And of course, if you follow what's been happening with Gaza, there's a whole settler movement within Israel that wants to resettle Israelis in the Gaza Strip. So getting back to your point, and I'll sort of sum this up. Israel has never seriously tried making peace. Peace would be very simple. You either have two states, which makes sense to me, or you have one state where everyone is an equal citizen. My view is that the Palestinians should be allowed to decide their own future. And that's where I draw the line. It's not for me to decide. But Israel has got to give back land. It's got to. It's illegally occupying a huge amount of land. It doesn't own that land. It's under international law. It's illegal to own that land. And I've seen no efforts, no serious efforts, including the Oslo Peace Accords, that really were intended to make peace with the Palestinians. They were intended to entrench the settlements, to entrench Israel's presence, and to keep a military occupation over the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza.
Well, we need to wrap up now, and there's still so much to talk about. Some of the articles that I've read and you've sent talking about the conditions of the Palestinians that have been released from the Israeli prisons and the torture that they've undergone, even though...
And where is this in our press? Why don't we see people who are being... who have acid poured on their backs? And why don't we see the people who have been raped by Israeli soldiers and by dogs? I mean, this isn't getting any press here. And this isn't one or two cases. This is hundreds of prisoners who are being subjected to starvation, to beatings, to being shackled, to sitting naked on gravel. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. It's unbelievable. But it doesn't get any press, so people here don't know about it.
And concerning to me today, although it seems unrelated in some ways, Trump having this and Vance having this fight with Zelensky at the White House, basically supporting the work, leaving an open door for the work of autocrats around the world. And a license in many ways. You bring up the West Bank. That seems like the next step, and that the Trump administration is not going to push back against the further aggression in the West Bank or in helping to resolve the situation in Gaza. So, it doesn't seem like it's going to get a lot better there.
No, it was very amusing to me to see Trump screaming at Zelensky and talking about how he wanted to prevent World War III from breaking out and that he needed to make peace. And all I could think of was, what do you think's happening in the Middle East? I mean, just because Israel is a small country doesn't mean it isn't armed to the teeth. I mean, World War III could break out there as well. And he's doing nothing about that. He's stoking the flames.
Well, anyway, thank you for your time, Jennifer Lowenstein. I encourage people, they can go to madisonrafa.org. There's a lot of other websites any that you can recommend to people to.
Oh, yeah, I can recommend a lot. I mean, I would say read Middle East Eye. It's free. You can read it every day. Read Common Dreams. It's also free. It's read Truth Out. Almost every day there are decent articles there that you can get and find information. Watch Al Jazeera English. The reporting on Palestine, on Gaza, on Lebanon is much better than anything we get in this country. The Arab News, go to Al Mayadeen in Lebanon. There are lots and lots of publications that really tell you what's happening in this country. But the mainstream media channels in this country, forget about it. You're not going to find it. You're not going to find real news there.
Well, thanks so much for your work and for spending the time with us. And
yeah, I'm in Tucson now, not Madison.
The great information, Jennifer Lowenstein.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.
You've been listening to Global Stuff Podcast, originally recorded on February 28th, 2025, talking about the situation in Israel and Gaza. You can go to kmud.org to find all of the Global Stuff podcasts online. My name's Jimmy Durschlag. Thanks for listening.